Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser, continued. Cassette 8, side 1. Pope wagged his fat head and said he understood that some thousands had come into the agencies and settled down quietly. "You don't say," cries Sherman scornfully. "Seen the Indian office figures, have you? Out of 53,000 Sioux, 46,000 are wild and scarcely tractable. Those are the very words, sir. Oh, they'll come into the agencies and collect the provisions we're fool enough to hand out to them, and the clothes and blankets and rifles. You bet they'll have the rifles. For hunting, naturally." He prepared to spit and remembered he was at a wedding. "Hunting white settlers and soldiers, I dare say. Know how many thousands of new rifles, Winchester and Remington repeaters, too, were shipped up the Missouri by Indian traders last year? How many million cartridges? No, you don't know, because Washington daren't say. And the benevolent government permits it to hostiles who've no least notion of settling on reservations or turning to farming or accepting the education offered them by a bunch of old women in pants back east who'd never dare put their noses west of St. Louis. Is it any wonder the Sioux think we're soft and grow more insolent by the day?" He let out a great snort of disgust. "Oh, the hell with it. I need a drink." He stumped off, and Crook shook his head. "He's right on one thing. It makes no sense to arm the tribes while we keep our own troops short of proper equipment. Someone is going to have to pay for that policy sooner or later, I fear. Probably someone in a blue coat, earning $13 a month to guard his country's frontier." It sounded very much like the usual soldiers' talk about politicians. Except that Sherman and Sheridan at least weren't usual soldiers. Sherman was commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army, and Little Phil commanded the Missouri Division, which meant the whole plains country to the Rockies. I didn't doubt they were well informed on the Indian question, and I knew the government was notoriously corrupt and inefficient, although Grant himself was said to be straight enough. Innocently, I said, I suppose the business of supplying the Indians was a very lucrative one. Pope choked on his drink. Sheridan shot me a glance, but Crook looked me straight in the eye. "That's the devil of it. A trader can get $100 in buffalo skins for one repeater and 20 cents a cartridge, but that's small beer to the profits of contractors who supply the agencies with rotten meat and moldy flour, or agents who cook their books and grow fat at the Indians' expense."
"Come now, George," cries Pope. "Not all agents are rascals."
"No, some of them are just incompetent," says Crook. "Either way, the Indian goes hungry, so I guess I can't blame him if he prefers not to rely on the agencies, except for weapons."
46,000 hostiles, well armed," says I. "That's about twice the size of the U.S. Army, isn't it?" "Gentlemen, we have a British spy in our midst," says Sheridan, laughing. "Yes, that's about right. But not all of those Indians are truly hostile, whatever Sherman thinks. Only a handful, in fact. The rest simply don't want to live on agencies and reservations. The few real wild spirits, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, and the like, don't amount to more than a few thousand braves. There's no danger of a general outbreak, if that's what you're thinking. No danger of that at all."
And now came Elspeth, tripping radiantly to reprove me for not presenting the famous General Crook, of whom she'd never heard, of course, but the little flirt knew a fine figure of a man when she saw one. So now Crook beamed and made a chest and bowed and called her my lady, and absolutely behaved like a faithful sheepdog, while I admired her performance with a jaundiced eye, and the talk murmured on under the trees in the drowsy summer afternoon. I did the polite with the prettiest bridesmaid at the punch bowl, and forgot all about Indians. It came back a few hours later, though, when the coincidence happened. Until Sheridan's wedding, I hadn't thought about redskins for years. And now, the very same day, the old West laid its horny hand softly on my shoulder for the second time. Elspeth and I were going into dinner at the Grand Pacific, and I turned into their big public lavatory to comb me whiskers, or adjust me galluses. I was barely aware of a largish man who was examining his chin closely in a mirror, and grunting to himself. And I was just buttoning up and preparing to leave when the humming ended in a rasping growl of surprise.
Indian, jolly good, washet you scap?
Englishman, Inyun and Hoi Ka are exclamations of surprise and disbelief.
Windbreaker, Hoi Ka!
I bore up sharp, for I don't suppose I'd heard Suan spoken in more than 20 years. And then I stood amazed. My companion had turned from the mirror, tweezers in hand, and was regarding me in delighted surprise. I gaped, for I couldn't credit it. There stood a figure in evening trousers and coat, starched front and all, and above it, the bronzed hawk face of a full-blooded Plains Indian brave, with a streak of paint just below the parting of his glossy black hair, which hung to his waist in long braided tails, one adorned with a red eagle's feather. Well, I'd known American hotels were odd, but this beat all. The apparition advanced, beaming.
You remember, at Fort Laramie, the year after the Great Sickness, you, me, Carson, the thrower of ropes, hon?
That means yes. Suddenly, the years fell away, and I was back in the hollow where Wotton and I skinned the buffalo, and that awful visitation, the painted face with the coon skin hanging from its cap, and a feast with the brulee at Laramie.
Jolly good, jolly good.
And the same black devil's eyes glinted at me. By some freak of memory, it was his Indian name that I remembered first.
Sinte Galeska, good God, can it be you?
He nodded vigorously.
The spotted tail, Hinte, how long has it been?
Hinte means incredible in their language.
You've gone well, windbreaker, with a little frost in your hair.
He pointed to the grey in my whiskers, chuckling. I was still taken all aback, as you would be if you'd met the King of the Cannibal Isles rushing naked round the South Seas, and 20 years later he tooled up to you in the Savoy in full evening fig, and began assailing you in broken English and a native tongue you'd all but forgotten. Why, the last time I'd seen him he'd been in breech clout and war bonnet, all smeared with buffalo blood. Now he was rumbling on in Sioux, and I was struggling to identify those sonorous vowels, dredging words from the back of my mind.
Hold on a moment. Anopta.
Stop.
Your spotted tail, the brulee, the killer of Pawnees.
And instinctively my hand went up to crook a finger at my brow, which is sign talk for Pawnee, the wolf folk. Heaven knew where that memory had come from, after so long. He crowed approvingly, nodding.
But what the devil are you doing? Here, I mean.
Here, Grand Pacific?
He shrugged massively.
It not so good. Palmer house better. Bully girl servants. Jolly pretty. But got no rooms, so my people and I come here. Huh?
This was a ridiculous dream, obviously.
I mean, what are you doing far from your lodge? In the city? In those clothes?
Oh!
I could have sworn his eyes twinkled.
The white man's robes, very proper. I have been to the teepee of the Great Father in Washington for powwow on high matters. Now we return to the place of my people, at my agency. The agency of Spotted Tail on the White River. Two sons in the Iron Horse. How, how? Wait.
And he thrust his great head at the mirror again, breathed gustily, tweaked a hair from his chin, and pocketed his tweezers. As he straightened his coat, I saw with alarm that he had a revolver in his armpit and a scalping knife in an embroidered scabbard thrust in his pants waistband.
How? We eat now, together, horses, duvers, and large snow puddings that make the tongue dead. Jolly good!
He grinned again and laid a huge paw on my shoulder.
My heart is as the lark to see again a friend from my youth who remembers the time when the buffalo covered the plains like a blanket. Hone!
Regret.
Come to grub.
Still recovering as I was suspecting that Mr. Spotted Tail, chief of the Brule Sioux, was something of a joker. My gift of language has always been good enough to enable me to turn my mind instantly to any tongue I've ever learned, no matter how long ago, so that within a minute of our meeting I was thinking in Siouan. And while I knew how picturesque it was with its splendid metaphors, I sensed that he was using them ironically as often as not. He didn't have to talk to me about the tippy of the great father, or snow puddings that make the tongue dead. He could just as easily have said White House, or ice cream. He knew the names of Chicago's hotels well enough and had a smattering of English. But he was smart as paint, and I guessed it suited him to play the romantic stage Indian when he came east on the Iron Horse to powwow. But I couldn't get over our strange meeting, and as we walked to the dining room, I demanded to know what he'd been doing, and where he'd learned English. Not that he had much.
In prison, says he calmly, at Fort Leavenworth, after we slew Grattan's pony soldiers, and the Isantanka put me in irons.
The Americans.
Yun!
An exclamation of pain.
And when the great powwows began between my people and the chiefs of the Isankanska,
the Long Knives, cavalry soldiers,
they took us to Washington to talk of treaties. Hey, hey!
Alas!
How they bit through our ears! Now I live at the agency with my people, the burned thighs, and they try to make us scratch the ground with iron spikes.
He shook with laughter.
And you, Windbreaker, you have been beyond the big water all these years among the Washachuska. Tell me of...
He stopped abruptly, staring, and then like a big cat slid aside behind a potted palm, peering ahead over its fronds.
Hinte hoaka ho!
I turned to see what had astonished him and understood. My dear wife, who is nothing, if not patient, was waiting on a couch by the dining room doors, fanning herself idly, and innocently ignoring the admiring glances of gentlemen passing through. She was wearing something blue from Paris, as I recall, which left her mostly bare to the waist, and to impress the colonials she had decorated her upper works with the diamond necklace presented to her by the Grand Duke Alexis, a lecherous Russian lout of our acquaintance. I'm proud to say that she was a sight to gladden the heart. Spotted Tail was grunting deep and pointing like a gun dog.
Hoppa! Hey, yes! Hoppa! That,
says he reverently,
is a woman.
Beautiful.
I believe you're right, says I. My wife, don't you know? Come along. My dear, may I present an old associate, Mr. Spotted Tail of the Sioux? Not the Berkshire Sioux, you understand, the Brulees. My wife, Lady Flashman.
He took her hand like a stricken grandee, bowing over it from his imposing height until his braids met. He implanted a smacking kiss you could have heard in Baltimore on her glove, murmuring,
Oh, lady, so pleased, so beautiful, just bully!
And his black eyes positively burned as he straightened up.
We hope I win.
Beautiful woman.
What? Hoppa, hoppa.
My fair one gave him a most wide-eyed, guileless smile, which I knew for a sure sign that she was willing to be dragged into the long grass at a moment's notice, and said in her shyest little voice that she was enchanted. He shot his cuff, thrust out an arm like a tree trunk, delicately placed her glove on it, and stalked with her into the dining room, crying,
Bess!
Attention for the head waiter. I followed on, marveling. I wouldn't have missed this for the salvation of mankind. He even had a table reserved, with his followers already installed. A couple of young braves, dressed civilized like himself, and a third with a coloured blanket over his shoulders, so it was hard to tell whether he was in faultless dinner rig underneath or not. He wore no shoes, though. But what took me aback was that there were two squaws, both wives of the chiefs, in fringed tunics. The whole party seated poker-faced at a large round table, heedless of the whisperings and amused glances of the civilized folk at neighbouring tables. There were only two spare seats, so Spotted Tail simply heaved the blanket-clad chap to the floor, seated Elspeth next to himself with great ceremony, waved me to a seat on his other hand, pushed the menu aside, and barked, "Horses, Duvers!" These proved to be hors d'oeuvre, and when he had gallantly helped Elspeth by jabbing a huge finger at each plate in turn and grunting, "Huh?" he took the entire tray before himself and engulfed the lot in about 2 minutes, using a knife and fork, if you'll believe it. I suppose I ate, but I confess I was too fascinated to pay much heed. It was startling enough that a great hotel admitted Indians, until I realized that they were used to these occasional delegations passing to and from Washington, and not only tolerated them, but made much of them for policy's sake. Also, they were a rare show for the other diners. I overheard covert whispers, "Why, they eat just like civilized people," and, "Isn't that chief a card, though? Wouldn't think to look at him, he's taken 100 scalps, would you?" And, "Well, they sure don't look like savage sea oxes to me. I think it's a great sell. Drop in and then sometime in their dining room and you'll learn different," thinks I to myself. But it was true, bar the outlandish contrast of the men's braids and painted faces to their formal suits, and the women's colourful buckskins, they weren't at all unlike the other diners. Better mannered, perhaps. They used the cutlery properly, didn't gorge or belch. Thinking back to Mangus, Colorado, or Spotted Tail himself tearing a bloody buffalo hump in his fingers, I could only wonder. Sat with perfect composure waiting for the courses, and preserved almost total silence during the meal, ne'er mind what they looked like, they had dignity by the bucket. They didn't stink, either, which astonished me. Spotted Tail, next to me, had evidently discovered cologne among other wonders of civilization. Unlike his fellows, he talked, so far as anyone can, to Elspeth. Another woman might have been bemused or shocked at finding herself dining with a painted savage, but my darling has never had but one rule. If it is male, between 14 and 80, and isn't humpbacked or cross-eyed, charm it. Which, oddly enough, she contrives to do by chattering incessantly and looking intent. Well, it means the chap can devote himself to looking at her, which Spotted Tail did most ardently. I realized with a qualm that with the paint and blood absent, he was a deuced fine-looking man, far handsomer even than most Sioux, and although he couldn't understand 1 word in 20 of what she said, he nodded and smiled most appreciatively. Once I heard him say,
"You, lady, you not Washachuska, English, hope he done."
That's an exclamation of amazement.
"You, Scottish, Scotch, ah!"
He considered this, and when the waiter presently whispered to her,
"French mustard, ma'am, English mustard,"
Spotted Tail threw back his great Sioux head, glared and demanded,
"For love, lee lady, why no Scotch mustard?"
That sent her into trills of laughter, and Spotted Tail beamed and patted her arm. "Aye," thinks I, "we must look out here." The young squaw beyond Elspeth evidently thought so too, for with an artless curiosity she leaned forward and began to finger Elspeth's necklace and earrings, murmuring with admiration. Women being what they are, in a moment they were comparing beads and materials. Spotted Tail sighed and turned to me, so I asked him what had become of his small nephew, the fair-haired boy. He sat back in astonishment.
"Little Curly? You don't know Inyan?
He shook his head at my ignorance.
The whole world knows him. He is a big Indian, maybe biggest war chief of all. He has great medicine, and his word runs from the Pahasapa to the Big Horn Hills, all through Powder River country. His lance touches the clouds, that little horseman of yours. You haven't heard of Tashunka Witko of the Aglala?
He repeated it in English.
Crazy horse!
I said I'd heard his name for the first time that afternoon, and recalled in wonder the laughing mite I'd carried on my saddle. Well, I'd said in jest that he'd be a great man some day. Now, I said, the Isantanka chief spoke of him as a maverick, the most hostile of Indians.
Ho, ho!
Cries Spotted Tail angrily, which is the Sioux equivalent of damn their eyes, or strong disapproval.
Hee-ya!
No.
He is a wild warrior. He counted Kuv on Fetterman and whipped the long knives at Lodge Trail Ridge. He is a fighter who hates Americans and has taken many soldier scalps, and they fear him because he makes no treaties and fights for his land and people. But his heart is good and his tongue is straight. Here, I am proud of Little Curly as a kinsman and a Lakota.
That's a Sioux.
What?
But you don't fight the Americans anymore. You make treaties for the burned thighs, I suppose, since you live on an agency. You even go softly to talk to the great father in his teepee, says I, to bait him. But he just gave me a long, slow smile.
Look, you... Windbreaker, I have seen 50 winters and 3. My war shirt bears more scalps of Pawnee and Crow and Shoshone and Isantanka soldiers than any in the Sioux Nation. 4 times I counted Cove on long knives in the fight of Bear that Scatters under Fort Laramie. Is it enough? It is enough. I have seen the white man's world now, the fire canoes and iron horses, the great teepees that touch the clouds, the lodge where fair young maidens guard the great father's gold, the cities where the people are like ants.
He grinned in embarrassment.
Once I thought they sent the same white people after us from city to city to make us think they were more numerous than they are. Now I know that in New York every day more people come from far lands than would make up the whole Lakota nation. Can Spotted Tail's lance and hatchet hold back all these?
No. They feel the land. They sweep away the buffalo. They plant seed on the prairie where I ran as a young boy. They make roads and railways over the hunting grounds.
Now they will take the Black Hills, the Pahasapa, and there will be no free land left to the Indian.
He broke off to roar,
Jolly good pudding!
As the waiter set about a gallon of ice cream before him, which he sank as smart as you like and waved for a second helping.
No, we cannot stop it, he went on. To fight is useless. This I know, and make the best terms I can for my own folk, because I see beyond these winters to the time when all the land is the white man's, and my children must be part of it or wither to nothing. Now others do not see as I do. Crazy Horse and Little Big Man, Black Moon, Gall and Sitting Bull, perhaps Old Red Cloud, they would fight to the last tuft of buffalo grass. They are wrong, and if they go out to battle with the long knives, I will stay in my lodge, not because my heart is weak, but because I am wise. But my heart is Lakota.
And he put back his great head, and I saw the gleam in the black eyes.
And for those that take the last war path, I shall say, Heyaki, it is a good day to die.
He said it matter-of-fact, without bluster or self-pity, and there's no doubt he was right. But then he was probably the greatest of the Sioux leaders, certainly the cleverest, and as he'd pointed out, quite the most distinguished in war. If the Sioux had heeded him, they'd have been a sight better off today. After dinner, he insisted that we accompany him to the theatre, taking Elspeth's hand and positively pleading with her through me as interpreter. I translated those compliments which were fit for her ears, with the result that presently we were bowling off in a cab, with Spotted Tail up beside the driver in a tile hat, roaring at him to go faster. The Squaws and Blanket Chap were left behind, and Elspeth and I shared the inside of the cab with the other two. Fine young bucks named Jack Moccasin and young Frank Standing Bear, who sat with their arms folded in grave silence. Elspeth confided to me that Standing Bear was quite distinguished-looking and had an air of true nobility. I might have guessed what entertainment Spotted Tail favoured. It proved to be the lowest kind of music hall down in the Loop District, what they call burlesque nowadays, with sawdust on the floor, a great bar down one side of the hall doing a roaring trade, a pit and gallery crowded with raucous toughs and their flash tarts, an atmosphere blue with smoke, and a programme to match. Capital stuff altogether. Comedians in loud coats and red noses singing filthy songs, and fat-thighed sluts in spangles and feathers shaking their bums at the orchestra. Elspeth, wearing her most fatuously ingenuous expression, affected not to understand a word. Only I knew, when the chief buffoon regaled us with jokes that would have shocked a drunk marine, that behind her fan she was struggling to contain an un-Presbyterian mirth which was in danger of bursting her stays. During the tableaux, scenes from the Sultan's Seraglio, Forbidden Paris, and The African Slave Girl's Dream of Innocence, she fanned herself languidly and examined the chandelier. Spotted Tail sat wooden-faced and motionless during most of the show, except for a deep internal growling throughout the tableaux. But when the conjurer came on, he bellowed approval, winded me with an elbow in the ribs, and fairly pounded his fist at every trick. Each vanishing card, emergent rabbit, and multiplying handkerchief was greeted with roars of Inyon! Hoi ka! Hopi dan! Wah! And when the buxom assistant finally stepped unharmed from a casket that had been thrust through with swords and riddled with pistol balls, the great chief of the Brulé Sioux arose from his seat, arms aloft, and bawled his applause to the ceiling. That conjurer, he told me as we left the theatre, was the greatest medicine man in the world. Wah! He was gifted beyond all other mortals. The great father himself was a child beside him. Indeed, why was that medicine man not made president? So flown was Spotted Tail that he banished Jack Moccasin to the box of the cab on the way home so that he could sit with us and describe each trick in awestruck detail. At least he described it to me and young Frank Standing Bear, while Elspeth listened in polite incomprehension. For the rest, said Spotted Tail, it had been a pretty rotten show. Except for the tableaux. There had been one girl with red hair whom he would have gladly taken to his teepee, and the black beauties in the slave's dream had reminded him of the girls he had seen in my wagons back in 49. I hadn't guessed, had I, he added with a sly grin, that he and his braves had stalked our caravan for 2 days in the hope of stealing one, but Blue Eye Wotton had been too watchful. He he. I was thankful that Elspeth didn't understand Siouan. So far as she knew, I'd crossed the plains with a company of farmers and Baptists who said prayers night and morning. I was also pleased to learn that Spotted Tail was leaving next day. I didn't tell Elspeth that he'd compared her favourably, and in indelicate detail, with the female performers at the theatre. But there was no mistaking the enthusiasm with which he pressed her hand on parting, or the fact that the vain little baggage went slightly pink, lowering her eyes demurely and positively purring. The deuce with this, thinks I, there'll be no more noble savages on this trip. And then,
Harry,
says she when we're in our room,
what does hoppa mean?
Beautiful, says I, middling sour. And we hoppawin, in case you didn't catch it, is a woman of surpassing loveliness.
Gracious me, the things men say. Can you unhook me at the back, dearest? Well, I must say I think it was rather forward of your Mr. Spotted Tail to pay me such compliments. Although I have no doubt he meant no disrespect. He's very gallant for a barbarian, don't you think? Quite distingué, really. Although his taste in entertainment is shockingly low.
He's distingué, all right, says I, unhooking moodily. Mostly for murder and robbery with violence. He's killed more men than the cholera. Women, too, I shouldn't wonder.
Thank you so much, my love. Oh, such relief. But you know, Harry, while I allow that it is highly distasteful, I don't see that it truly signifies if he's killed people or not. So have you. I've seen you. And so have any number of our military acquaintances. Why, probably even that nice American general with the large beard whom we met today.
Crook, says I, reclining wearily.
Yes. Well, I dare say that in the course of his duties, General Crook may well have taken human life. Although he has such kind eyes. Harry,
says she earnestly, surveying herself in the delectable buff before the pier glass, turning this way and that with her hands on her hips.
Do you think I'm Hoppa?
Come over here, says I, taking notice, and I'll show you.
I believe I have increased slightly about the hips and elsewhere. Do you think it can be a consequence of the American cuisine, these rich puddings?
Don't talk about 'em. Just bring 'em here. There's a girl. And if you want to lose weight, you know, a foolish whim in my view, I can give you a capital massage, like the Turkish bath people. Here, I'll show you.
Do you think it would be efficacious? If so, I should be much obliged to you, Harry, for I've read that it is beneficial, and I think I should not care to be too plump. Oh, you designing wretch, what deceit. No, now, desist this minute, for I see you're not really interested in reducing me at all.
Ain't I, though? Come along now, nothing like healthy exercise.
Exercise, indeed, you're a shameless monster to beguile me so. And at my age, too, it is too bad, and you are a wicked tease. But I'm gratified if you think I'm Hoppa. What was the other word? Whipple something?
We hope I win, and no error. My God, just shut up, will you?
They're such musical words. Gently, dearest. Are they not? They make me think of the brooding solitude of deep eternal forests with stately Chingachgook beside the council fire. The fragrance of the peace pipe and the cry of the elk among snow-clad peaks. Harry, my sweet, you are so vigorous that I'm quite breathless and fear for my digestion. Perhaps if I go on top. Well, now that we have met Mr. Spotted Tail and his friends, I am more resolved than ever to see the native Indians in their natural surroundings, just like the deer slayer, and
could we leave Fenimore Cooper for the moment, you babbling beauty? Says I, gasping as we changed over. Oh, ah, oh, Elspeth, I love you, you adorable houri. Please, for heaven's sake.
To observe them with their papooses and wigwams, I'm sure, would be highly edifying and instructive, for I believe they have many singular customs and ceremonies not to be seen elsewhere,
continued the lovely idiot, squirming in a way that any respectable matron would have forgotten years before.
And I am certain that Mr. Tail would render us, yes, my hero, in a moment, every assistance, and it would be such a romantic journey, which you know so well, and it would be so selfish of you not to take me, and you're not selfish, I'm sure. I hope not. Are you, Harry?
No. Oh, God, anything. I'll think about it. Please.
Oh, thank you, kindest of husbands. Dear me, I believe I'm about to swoon. Now, when I count to three, one, two, you will take me, dearest Harry, won't you? 2½.
As I said before, it was all her fault. Chapter 16. Naturally, I did my best to wriggle out of it next day, since the artful baggage had taken such unfair advantage of me, first provoking my jealousy, and then my ardour, stirring her rump before the mirror. Did I think she was hopa, forsooth, and extracting a half promise when she had me in extremis, when she called me designing? And all because she'd taken a passion for that damned Sioux, what with his feral charm and her nursery dreams of noble savages, forgotten while she'd had the social circus of Boston to distract her butterfly brain. They had revived under his smouldering regard, and I guess she was having delicious shivers at the thought of him sweeping her off at his saddle bow and having his wicked will of her by the shores of Gitche Gummy. She'd been just the same with that fat greaser Suleiman Usman, who had filled her head with twaddle about being his white jungle queen. Well, I wasn't risking that again. The trouble with Elspeth, you see, is that while I doubt if she really wants to be abducted and ravished by hairy primitives, well, not exactly, she's such a congenital flirt that she sometimes gets more than she bargains for. So, I wasn't going to have her making a western jaunt an excuse for renewing fond acquaintance with Master Spotted Tail, who'd have her in the bushes quicker than knife. But when I said that on reflection I decided that a trip west would be too taxing for her, there were tears and sobs of, "But you promised." So, in the end, I gave way, secretly determining that whatever route we took would run well clear of his agency. Given that, I didn't mind indulging her girlish fantasies with a brief tour of the wilds in a transcontinental Pullman. She could have her fill of vast plains and brooding forests from the window of a private hotel car. And never mind Chingachgook. We might stop off at some tame Indian village. One sniff of that would cure our notions. And perhaps a cattle ranch or gold mine. It could all be done in luxurious comfort and perfect safety. You see, it was all changed since my early days. The map was being filled in. The great wilderness had its railroads and stage lines now, its forts and towns and ranches and mines. It was still wild, in parts, some of it even virtually unexplored. But there wasn't a true frontier anymore, in the sense of a north-south line dividing civilization from outer darkness. If you look at the map, you'll see what I mean. The train and the steamboat had forged the links across the continent, and up and down, leaving only the spaces in between. The most important of these, for my story, was the great stretch of the high plains, in what is now Montana, Wyoming, and the Dakotas. To east and north it was bounded by the Missouri River, along which the steamboats carried the western traffic to the foot of the Rockies, and to the south by the railroad from Omaha to Cheyenne and the Great Salt Lake. These were the arteries of civilization along which you could travel as swiftly and safely, with luck anyway, as from London to Aberdeen. It was the land they enclosed that was the trouble, for while the boats and trains might run round its limits, there wasn't much going through it, not in a hurry. This was the last stamping ground of the Sioux, the biggest and toughest Indian confederacy in North America, a greater thorn in Washington's side than even my old friends the Apaches of the Southwest. 50,000 Sioux, Sherman had reckoned, and their allies the Northern Cheyenne, first cousins to those stone-faced giants I'd met on the Arkansas. In those days, the Sioux had been lords of the prairie from the Santa Fe Trail to the British border, from Kansas to the Rockies, tolerating the wagon trains, give or take a raid now and then, and rubbing along quietly enough with the few troops that the Americans sent into the West. All that had changed, the ever-advancing settlements, the bypassing of their country by rail and river, had forced the plains tribes back from the limits of civilization around them into their heartland, bewildered and angry. They'd broken out in Minnesota in 62, and been put down. When the government tried to put the Bozeman Road slap through their territory, Red Cloud had taken the warpath and fought them to a standstill. But although the road was given up and the forts abolished, their victory probably did the Sioux more harm than good, since it convinced the wilder spirits that the Yanks could be stopped by force. They didn't see it was a struggle they must lose in the end. And so for 25 years, the scrappy, unorganized warfare had smoldered on, with every now and then a real dust-up to stoke the growing hatred and mistrust on both sides. Crazy Horse had hammered Fetterman. Spotted Tail and Co. had lifted 80 cavalry scalps almost in Laramie's backyard. On the American side, the Cromwellian lunatic Chivington had butchered the Arapaho and Cheyenne at Sand Creek. And Custer, on the Washita, had descended on Black Kettle's village with his flutes tootling Gary Owen, and left more than 100 corpses in the snow. These were the solo pieces, so to speak, but always there was the accompaniment of burned settlements, derailed trains and ambushed wagons, and punitive expeditions, dispossessions and tribal evictions. Naturally, each side blamed the other for bad faith and treachery and refusal to see reason. The Indian version of Washita, for example, was that Custer wantonly attacked a peaceful village, but one of his troopers told me he'd seen freshly taken white scalps in the Indian lodges. Choose who you will to believe. The wiser Sioux leaders, like Spotted Tail and Red Cloud, saw how it must end and made peace. But that solved nothing, while the real Ishmaels, like Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, remained beyond the pale. And even the treaty Indians broke out from time to time, for the agents who were meant to supply them cheated them blind as often as not. Washington neglected them, and life on a reservation or agency was a poor thing compared to roaming their ancestral plains and robbing when they felt like it. By 1875, though it looked as though the thing must peter out at last, hunters and sportsmen had swept the buffalo off the prairie at a rate of a million a year, until they were all but extinct. And the Indian without buffalo is worse off than the Irish without the potato, for its clothing and lodging to him as well as food. Plainly, even the wildest hostiles would have to chuck it and settle down soon. The discovery of gold in the Black Hills, which would inevitably mean the loss to the tribes of yet another stretch of territory, must only hasten the process, for it would leave them little except the barely explored fastness south of the Yellowstone, called the Power River Country, and with game so scarce, they would have to call it a day or starve. That was the general view, so far as I could gather, and with it went the opinion that I'd heard from Sheridan. However it ended, there wouldn't be a war. An ugly incident or two here and there, perhaps regrettable, but probably inevitable with such people. But no real trouble. No, sir. Which was most comforting to me as I considered how to satisfy my darling's hunger to see the Wild West. Yes, the railroad would carry us well clear of the dangerous Sioux country, and Spotted Tail, incidentally.